Good evening. It's March 1st, 2016. We're in Gainesville, Florida at the Gainesville Retreat Center. Tonight's talk by the Venerable Bhante Vimalaramji will be on Majjhima Nikaya number 18, the Madhupindika Sutta, the Honeyball Sutta.
Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country at Kapilavastu in Nigrodha's park. When it was morning, the Blessed One dressed, taking his bowl and outer robe, went into Kapilavastu for alms. When he'd wandered for alms in Kapilavastu and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he went to the great wood for the day's abiding. Entering the great wood, he sat down at the root of a bulbous sapling for the day's abiding. Dandapani, the Sakyan, while walking and wandering for exercise, also went to the great wood. And when he entered the great wood, he went to the bulva sapling where the Blessed One was and exchanged greetings with this. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood at one side, leaning on his stick. Now, what that means is he was being rude from the very beginning. If he had a question, he should at least pay respect and sit down at one side. But he was standing. And asked the Blessed One, what does the recluse assert? What does he proclaim? Friend, I assert and proclaim my teaching in such a way that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its maras, and its brahmas. In this generation, with its recluses and brahmins, its princes and its people, in such a way that perceptions no more underlie that brahmin who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for anything. When this was said, Dandapani, the Sakyan, shook his head, he wagged his tongue, and raised his eyebrows until his forehead was puckered with three lines. Then he departed, leaning on his stick. Then, when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and went to Nigrodha's park, where he sat down on a seat made ready for him and told the monks what had taken place. Then a monk asked the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, how does the Blessed One assert and proclaim his teaching in such a way that he does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its maras, and its brahmas? In this generation, with his recluses and brahmins, its princes and its people, and Venerable Sir, how is it that perception no more underlie the Blessed One, that Brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, shorn of worry, free from craving for anything? One of the things about this particular sutta that I wanted to warn you about is that there is a lot of repetition in the sutta. Don't let your mind wander. Let it sink in. Monk, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, If nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to aversion, of the underlying tendency to craving, of the underlying tendency to views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, of the underlying tendency to conceit, of the underlying tendency to desire for being, of the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. That is what the Blessed One said. Having said this, the Sublime One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling. Now, the monks that he said this to made a major mistake, and they didn't ask him to explain what he was talking about. Kind of like here. You don't ask questions. Okay. Soon after the Blessed One had gone, the monks considered, "Now, friends, the Blessed One has risen from his seat and gone into his dwelling. After giving a summary in brief without expounding the detailed meaning. Now, who will expound this to us?" Then they considered the venerable Mahakachana as praised by the teacher and esteemed by his wise companions in the holy life. He is capable of expounding the detailed meaning. Suppose we went to him and asked him the meaning of this. Then the monks went to the venerable Mahakachana and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, they sat down at one side and told him what had taken place, adding, "Let the venerable Mahakachana expound it to us." Now guess what's going to happen? Mahakachana is going to verbally slap them. The venerable Mahakachana replied, "Friend, it is as though a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, thought that heartwood should be sought for among the branches and leaves of a great tree standing possessed of heartwood. After he passed over the root and the trunk, so it is with you, venerable sirs, that you think I should be asked about the meaning of this. After you pass the Blessed One by, when you were face to face with the teacher, for knowing, the Blessed One knows. Seeing, he sees. He is vision. He is knowledge. He is the Dhamma. He is the Holy One. He is the sayer, the proclaimer, the elucidator of meaning, the giver of the deathless, the Lord of the Dhamma, the Tathagata. That was the time that you should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. As he told you, so you should have remembered it. Surely, friend Kachana, knowing the Blessed One knows, seeing he sees. He is knowledge, he is Dhamma, he is the Holy One, he is the sayer, the proclaimer, the elucidator of meaning, the giver of the deathless, the Lord of the Dhamma, the Tathagata. That was the time that we should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. as he told us we should have remembered it. Yet the venerable Mahakachana is praised by the teacher and esteemed by his wise companions in the holy life. The venerable Mahakachana is capable of expounding the detailed meaning of this summary given in brief by the Blessed One. Without expounding the detailed meaning, let the venerable Mahakachana expound it without finding it troublesome. Then listen, friends, and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, friends, the monks replied. The venerable Mahakachana said this. Friends, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling after giving a summary in brief, without expounding the detailed meaning, that is, monk, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to aversion, of the underlying tendency to craving, of the underlying tendency to views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, of the underlying tendency to conceit, of the underlying tendency to desire for being, of the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Malicious words means cursing. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. I understand the detailed meaning to be as follows. Dependent on the I and forms I consciousness arises. The meaning of the three is I contact. With eye contact as condition, there is eye feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one craves. What one craves, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to the past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. Dependent on the ear and sounds, ear consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is ear contact. With ear contact as condition, there is ear feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. Do you understand what that means? When a feeling arises, if it's a pleasant feeling, you perceive it as pleasant. If it's a painful feeling, you perceive it as painful. What one perceives, that one craves. So that's how craving comes up and the false idea in a personal self arises. What one craves, that one thinks about. That's the clinging, right? All of your stories, your opinions, your ideas. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. Mentally proliferating means you're getting caught in the story. And you're taking it personally. and you really cause yourself a lot of suffering. So that's why as soon as feeling arises, you want to be able to relax the tension and tightness caused in your head. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation, all of your stories, this is your habitual tendency where emotion comes in. Okay, a lot of people that are teaching Buddhism, they say feeling is emotion. And that's not right. Feeling is just feeling. Feeling is either a pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling. And right after feeling and perception of that arises is when craving arises, the subtle tightness that happens in your head. When you recognize that, and relax. Your mind doesn't have any more mental proliferation arising. And what does that mean? You've let go of suffering. You have a pure mind because you've let go of the craving. And bring that clear, bright, pure mind back to something wholesome. And that is? You're mentally proliferating right now. Come on, give me an answer out loud. What is? Okay, that's better. Boy, it's like pulling hen's teeth, you know? And what do you do after you smile? You bring that light, smiling mind that's pure, that doesn't have any craving in it, back to your object of meditation. Now, some of you are really starting to progress very nicely in your meditation. And that says that you are starting to understand more deeply how this process works. And you're starting to cut off the mental proliferation. And that means you're letting go of suffering. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. What does that mean? Your opinions, your ideas, the things that you really hold dear. This is the way it works. I don't care what you said. Okay, that's how you get in quarrels and brawls and disputes. Because of mental proliferation. And this mental proliferation besets a man with respect to the past, future, and present sounds cognizable through the ear. Dependent on the nose and odors, nose consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is nose contact. With nose contact as condition, there is nose feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one craves. What one craves, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates, causing yourself more and more suffering. That's why I've told you just about every Dhamma talk, don't get involved in the content of the thoughts. The content doesn't mean anything. That's where you take things personally, and your mind grabs on, and that's how that craving comes up. And there's a lot of suffering. You take a little problem, and you turn it into Mount Everest. You can't go over it. You can't go around it. You can't go under it. This is a major problem when you get caught in your mental proliferations. So, when we see the craving and let go of that, that mental proliferation doesn't occur. Your mindfulness needs to improve so that you're able to observe how this process works. And I'm showing you in this sutta how this process works. What one craves, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to the past, future, and present odors cognizable through the nose. Dependent on the tongue and flavors, tongue consciousness arises. The meeting of these three things is called tongue contact. That means you have a tongue, there is flavor that arises, tongue consciousness arises. These three things are called tongue contact. Okay? With tongue contact as condition, there is tongue feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one craves. What one craves, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. And you're caught in your suffering when you get to do that. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to the past, future, and present, taste cognizable through the tongue. Dependent on the body and tangibles, body consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is body contact. With body contact as condition, there is body feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one craves. What one craves, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to past, future, and present. Tangibles cognizable through the body. Dependent on mind and mind objects, mind consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is mind contact. With mind contact as condition, there is mind feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one craves. What one craves, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one is mentally proliferated as the source, perception and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to the past, future, and present. Mind objects cognizable through the mind. When there is the I of form and I consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of eye contact. When there is the manifestation of eye contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of eye feeling. When there is the manifestation of eye feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's the manifestation of craving, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there is the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there is the ear, a sound, and ear consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of ear contact. When there is the manifestation of ear contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of ear feeling. When there is the manifestation of ear feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's the manifestation of craving, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there is the nose and odors and nose consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of nose contact. When there's the manifestation of nose contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of nose feeling. When there is the manifestation of nose feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there is the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there is the manifestation of craving, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there is the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there is the tongue of flavor and tongue consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of tongue contact. When there is the manifestation of tongue contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of tongue feeling. When there is the manifestation of tongue feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's the manifestation of craving, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there is the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there is the body, a tangible and body consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of body contact. When there's the manifestation of body contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of body feeling. When there is the manifestation of body feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there is the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there is the manifestation of craving, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there is the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there is mind, mind object, and mind consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of mind contact. When there is the manifestation of mind contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of mind feeling. When there is the manifestation of mind feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there is the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. Craving. When there is the manifestation of craving, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there is no I, no form, no I consciousness, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of eye contact. When there is no manifestation of eye contact, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of eye feeling. When there is no manifestation of eye feeling, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's no manifestation of perception, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's no manifestation of craving, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's no manifestation of thinking, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there is no ear, no sound, no ear consciousness, then it is impossible to point out the manifestation of ear contact. When there's no manifestation of ear contact, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of ear feeling. When there's no manifestation of ear feeling, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of ear craving. When there's no manifestation of ear craving, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's no manifestation of thinking, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there's no tongue, no flavor, no tongue consciousness, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of tongue contact. When there's no manifestation of tongue contact, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of tongue feeling. when there's no manifestation of tongue feeling, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's no manifestation of perception, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's no manifestation of craving, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's no manifestation of thinking, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. When there's no body, no tangible and no body consciousness, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of body contact. When there's no manifestation of body contact, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of body feeling. When there's no manifestation of body feeling, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's no manifestation of perception, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of craving. When there's no manifestation of craving, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there's no manifestation of thinking, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. Friends, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling, after giving summary in brief without expounding the detailed meaning, that is, monk, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to aversion, of the underlying tendency to craving, of the underlying tendency to views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, of the underlying tendency to conceit, of the underlying tendency to desire for being, of the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. I understand the detailed meaning of this summary to be thus. Now, friends, if you wish, go to the Blessed One and ask him the meaning of this. As the Blessed One explains it to you, you should remember it. Then the monks, having delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Mahakachana's words, rose from their seats and went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, they sat down at one side and told the Blessed One all that had taken place after he had left, adding, "Then, Venerable Sir, we went to the Venerable Mahakachana and asked him about the meaning. The Venerable Mahakachana expounded the meaning to us with these terms, statements, and phrases." Mahakachana is wise, monks. Mahakachana has great wisdom. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way that Mahakachana has explained it. Such is the meaning of this, and so you should remember it. When this was said, Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, just as if a man exhausted by hunger and weakness came upon a honey ball. Wherever he would taste it, he would find a sweet, delectable flavor. So too, venerable sir, any able-bodied monk, wherever he might scrutinize with wisdom the meaning of this discourse on the Dhamma, would find satisfaction and confidence of mind. Venerable sir, what is the name of this discourse on the Dhamma? As to that, Ananda, you may remember this discourse on the Dhamma as the Honeyball Discourse. That is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So this particular sutta is giving you an introduction into how dependent origination works. Okay. The first link of dependent origination is ignorance. What is ignorance? What does it mean? Say it again. No. Yes, but what does ignorant mean? It means you're ignoring how the Four Noble Truths work. That's what ignorance is. Now, I've heard many, many, many discourses. And just about everybody that talks about the Four Noble Truths talks about it in very general terms. And the Four Noble Truths are very, very specific. Okay. Went right to that page. Okay. Now I'm going to show you how the Four Noble Truths are in each link of dependent origination. Now this is from the Nidana Sutta, the Book of Causation. There's 84 discourses just on dependent origination in here. Monks, as to those ascetics and Brahmins who do not understand these things means the links of dependent origination. And it also means suffering. And I'll explain that in a bit. The origin of these things are First Noble Truth. The origin of these things, Second Noble Truth. The cessation of these things, Third Noble Truth. The way leading to the cessation of these things, Fourth Noble Truth. What are these things that they do not understand, whose origins they do not understand, whose cessations they do not understand, and the way leading to whose cessation they do not understand? They do not understand aging and death. That's suffering. Each link is suffering. Why? Because it's conditioned. Its origin, its cessation, and the way leading to its cessation. They do not understand birth, They do not understand habitual tendency. They do not understand clinging. They do not understand craving. They do not understand feeling. They do not understand contact. They do not understand the six sense bases. They do not understand mentality and materiality. They do not understand consciousness. They do not understand preparations. Their origin, cessation, and the way leading to their cessation. So each one of these links, if you don't understand how the Four Noble Truths work with each link, you will do meditation for a long time without being successful. These are the things they do not understand, whose origins they do not understand, whose cessation they do not understand, and the way leading to whose cessation they do not understand. These I do not consider to be ascetics among ascetics, or Brahman among Brahmins, and these venerable ones do not, by realizing it for themselves, with direct knowledge in this very life, dwell in the goal of asceticism or the goal of Brahmanhood. What is that saying? If you don't see how the links of dependent origination actually do work, you're not going to attain Nibbana. But monks, as to those ascetics and Brahmins who understand these things, the origin of these things, the cessation and the way leading to the cessation of these things, they understand aging and death, its origin, cessation, and way leading to its cessation. And then it goes through all of the links again. These are the things they understand, whose origin they understand, whose cessation they understand, and the way leading to whose cessation they understand. I consider these to be ascetics among ascetics, and Brahmins among Brahmins. And these venerable ones, by realizing it for themselves with direct knowledge, in this very life, enter and dwell in the goal of asceticism and the goal of Brahmanhood. So understanding the links of dependent origination through your meditation. Now you've heard me talk over and over again about how some of this works. A feeling arises. It's pleasant, painful, neither painful nor pleasant. Craving comes up right after that. I like it if it's pleasant, I don't like it if it's painful. Right after that, all of your thoughts, opinions, ideas, and stories arise. And this is where the false idea in a personal self gets set in cement, where you really, you're taking all of these thoughts and opinions and ideas very personally. Right after that, your habitual emotional tendency arises. And when this painful feeling arises, you get caught up in thinking and mental proliferation, and then you really get caught up in this and try to control the feeling with your thoughts. I don't like this feeling. I want it to stop. I want it to go away. Who doesn't like it? Who wants to control it? You can't control feelings with thoughts because feelings are one thing and thoughts are something else. It doesn't work. Right now, there's almost an epidemic in this country with depression. And I went to a naturopathic college and gave a talk, and somebody raised their hand and they said, how can we teach people to overcome depression? It's actually very easy to overcome depression. Don't take it personally. It's not yours. A feeling arises. I don't like that feeling. It's painful. I got my story about it. I have my habitual tendency that keeps trying to control it. And that is the cause of the birth of action and sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. That's how this suffering arises. So what do I tell them? If their depression is real bad, I teach them about the six R's. Because you can overcome this very easily when you stop taking it personally. And I also teach them it's okay to have fun in life. Somebody that's depressed doesn't want to hear that sort of thing. Oh, this is suffering. I don't like this. I'd rather just go get some medicine from the doctor and then dull out for the rest of your life, taking that medicine because you're afraid of depression. And what's the side effect of some of these pills that you have to take? One of the side effects is more depression and psychotic behaviors, especially with kids. They give these kids all of these drugs because kids are naturally pretty active, especially boys when they're growing up. And they don't give them physical education in school anymore. They'd rather drug them out so that they'll be quiet in class. No. It doesn't work. If you're truly depressed, go to a hospital where somebody's dying of cancer and tell me that your depression is worse than that. I worked at a mental institute in Malaysia for a short time because I was starting to show people how to be happy again, and the doctors didn't like that. But the first part of meditation is practicing your generosity, right? So what I would do would get some dirty clothes from this person, and I would give them to somebody else and say, could you help them out? They need their clothes washed, and they're really not doing good right now. And then they'd go do it. And then they'd bring the clean clothes back, and they started feeling pretty good about themselves. And I was taking everybody's clothes, and I was changing them all around so that they would stop spending so much time thinking about themselves. Start thinking about other people. When people go to the mental institute, people say, oh, they're out of their mind. And that's actually not true. they're into their mind so much that they don't relate to the outside world. So what does generosity do? Generosity helps pull them out a little bit. And then every day when I first got there, one of the things I did was I told them that they had to stand in front of the mirror in the bathroom and they had to smile for a whole minute. A minute is a long time, especially when you don't feel like it. Oh, my face is so ugly. No, have to let that one go. Just smile. Stop taking your thoughts and feelings so personally. Painful feelings are going to come up. Welcome to real life. It's going to happen. What are you going to do with that when it arises? You're going to fight with that painful feeling and try to think that painful feeling away and make yourself suffer more? Or you can use the six R's and smile and bring that smiling mind to wish somebody happiness. Okay? Now, the interesting thing about the Eightfold Path, the last of the Noble Truths, is that nobody that's practicing meditation really seems to understand that this is really important to understand. Now, I don't like the way that most people talk about this is right view and this is right thought and this is right speech and all of these different things. There's always this is the right thing. And it really, if there's a right, then there's a wrong. And there's no in-between ground in that. So I've changed that. And I change it to harmonious. And I don't like the idea of right view. I call it harmonious perspective. What is your harmonious perspective? Seeing that everything is impersonal. There's nothing in this world that is personal. Everything, every physical thing, every mental thing is part of an impersonal process. So when you have a harmonious perspective, in one of the suttas here, somebody, let me go to it. When your mind is truly pure, The Buddha said that you were developing the eye of wisdom. What is the eye of wisdom? The eye of wisdom is seeing that everything is impersonal. The next part of the next fold of the Eightfold Path, they call it right thought. Bhikkhu Bodhi in his later additions has changed that to right intention, and I really don't agree with that very much. I call this harmonious imaging. What kind of an image do you hold of yourself? I'm always poor. You hold that image, you will be. I'm always happy. You hold that image of yourself and you will be. So harmonious imaging is a very necessary thing to have for a wholesome mind. If you're in harmony with your image, you become that. I am a very prosperous person, and I really am. And I've built a meditation center, and it's going to be turning into a monastery before long. And we've put about $750,000 into it. And I don't have any money. How can I do that? Being prosperous doesn't mean money. Being prosperous means having a lot of friends and being able to help other people and being able... I travel all over the world. Why? Because people like me enough that they want me to come around and help them. My family can't understand how I can live as well as I do. You're always going around the world. Yeah? Where are you going this time? Where do you get the money to do that? I don't worry about it. I take care of Dhamma. When you take care of Dhamma, Dhamma takes care of you. And it's really, really true. Before I became a monk, I worked in Southern California. And I wanted to be around people that were dying, because I wanted to see what dying was all about. I had read some Buddhist books on this, and I thought, okay, let's check it out. So I happened to get a job at my mother's nursing home. And I was given very little money for doing this, but I got to be around people as they were dying, and she'd been doing it for 20 years, so she knew within a day whether somebody was going to die or not. And when they were getting ready to die, I would, because they were Christians, I took the Bible and started reading different Bible verses to them because it made their mind peaceful and calm. And I happened to run across one thing in the Bible that was very interesting, and it was in Matthew. And it was the precepts are in the Bible. Now, when somebody takes the precepts, when they're getting close to death, their mind is very uplifted. And they will be reborn in a very nice rebirth. But I was only making $100 a week. And I was paying $50 a week for room and board with family members. And there was a lady there that she had a disease where her brain was shrinking. And I thought that maybe if she got some acupuncture, we could change that around. And I went to the family and I said, I want to take her to get some acupuncture and see if it helps her to be her memory to come back and things like that. And they said, fine, you can do that, but we're not going to pay for it. And I said, I don't care. So I was paying $35 a week for her acupuncture treatment. I gave $10 a week to a monastery. I sent it every week to India. I gave $10 a week to my mother. Now add that up and it's $105. I only had $100. But I was spending $105 a week. And I always had money in my pocket. I was teaching meditation. I was helping set up a hospice. I was going out to people that were dying through the hospice, as well as being at the nursing home, with being with people so that they could have an uplifted mind. I didn't worry about where the money was coming from. And sometimes people would just come up and give me money. And if they gave me money, I would go give it to the hospice. They needed it more than I did. I lived that way for 8 months. I walked everywhere I wanted to go. But sometimes I needed a ride to go into San Diego. I was living about 25 miles outside of San Diego. And somebody I knew would come and say, where are you going? I got to go into town. I got to go to San Diego. Okay, come on with me. If you take care of Dhamma, Dhamma takes care of you. If you keep your precepts without breaking them, and this means for real, all kinds of wonderful things start happening for you. Because you're taking care of Dhamma in this way, you start to prosper. And a lot of people really start appreciating you and helping you. An interesting thing with the precepts is people that don't keep the precepts, when they get in a stressful situation, they always act in the wrong way. For instance, I worked in Hawaii. I lived there for a couple of years in the 70s. And I was a waiter, and it was a great job. I mean, I could work 3 days a week, 5 hours a day, have enough money to go do whatever else I wanted in Hawaii, and that's great fun. Anyway, this is back when they allowed smoking in the restaurants. Somebody had taken a cigarette and didn't put it out all the way. Somebody else came along and just threw it in with the paper. And I was on the other side of the restaurant. And I heard somebody say, fire! And I went, oh, fire, okay. And I looked and there's this fire coming out of this trash can. And three people were standing right beside it yelling fire. And they didn't do anything. And I very calmly walked across the restaurant, got a pitcher of water, and put the fire out. Those people, they didn't keep their precepts very well. They didn't know what to do when it was needed. They acted in the wrong way. I had a friend that her sister had a daughter, and she popped a olive in her mouth, and it got stuck in her throat. Her sister started running, ran out of the house, ran down the street, yelling, "Help!" And my friend gave her the thing and popped the olive out. She kept her precepts very well. She knew what to do at the right time. People get really overexcited if they don't keep their precepts. And their mind just does all kinds of crazy things. So you keep your precepts without breaking them, you will act appropriately when it's needed. This is harmonious imaging. You image yourself as a person that doesn't break the precepts. Now, in Asia, it's really kind of funny because they're really into saving face and all of this kind of thing. So they have justified to themselves that it's okay to tell a little white lie. And a little white lie is a lie. It's better to say nothing than it is to say something that you know is not true. It makes a big difference. And if you do happen to say something that's not true, that little quiet voice in your mind says, "I shouldn't have said that." And then you just kind of flip it off and don't worry about it. But then you come for a retreat. You sit in meditation and you have restlessness coming up a lot. Why? Because you broke a precept. These are not commandments. It's your choice whether you keep your precepts or not. I had one student I've been teaching for over 35 years. Didn't have any progress in his meditation. Cursed like a trooper. I mean, he was always using foul language. Every day he was using foul language. He would come for a two-week retreat, go through all kinds of hindrances and all kinds of problems. The last two or three days of the retreat, his mind settled down. He had some progress. But for 2 weeks, I mean, that's a lot of big waste of time. He was breaking the precepts, and he told me, finally I'm off retreat. Now I can go back to the way I was. 35 years. Well, I hit this wall in my meditation. Yeah, that wall is your mouth. But eventually, I finally got him to stop doing that. And he became successful with his meditation. So it's real important for you to understand, yeah, these precepts are there, and it's real good that you keep them. Don't say something you know is wrong. Don't divide people. Bring people together. Don't gossip. What's gossip? Oh, it's talking about somebody when they're not there? No, that's not gossip. It's making up stories about people that aren't there. Saying things that you know aren't true. That's what gossip is. So keeping your precepts, not having any wrong sexual activity, not stealing anything from somebody else, not killing living beings or harming living beings. When you keep your precepts without breaking them and you come and do a retreat, your progress in the meditation is going to be fast. I had one man that came, never done any meditation before. He listened very attentively to the directions in practicing loving kindness. Came in for the first interview. How long's your best sitting? 4 hours. The first day he's done a retreat. He sat for 4 hours. Did you have joy? Yeah, I had joy. Did the joy go away and you feel nice balance in your mind and very comfortable? Yeah. Does your mind have very strong balance and you have a lot of tranquility? Yeah. The first day he had ever done any meditation, he got to the fourth jhana. Now that's really not the norm. That's really, really unusual. But he was ready for it. And I asked him about keeping his precepts. I said, "You keep your precepts?" He said, "I can't even remember growing up as a child breaking a precept." Wow, that's really something. That's why his progress was so fast. He didn't have mental proliferation because he didn't break his precepts. He didn't have this active mind. So the more you can keep the image of keeping your precepts without breaking them, then you start to become more prosperous on your own. You're taking care of the Dhamma. The next fold of the Eightfold Path is, they call it right speech, and I don't really care for that very much, so I call it harmonious communication. And almost everybody has this idea that it's only when you're talking to somebody else. But who do you talk with most in your life? Yourself. How much do you beat yourself up? How much do you criticize yourself? How much do you come down on yourself because you don't meet your own expectation? Every thought of doing that is unwholesome. Now, some of you have said, be kind to yourself. And I really, literally mean, be nice to yourself. Don't criticize yourself. You're only causing problems for yourself. You're only causing pain, suffering, and grief. You don't need to do that to yourself. Smile with yourself. Be happy. Use gratitude a lot. One of the things that happens when I go to Asia is they always treat me in a very special way. And they give me they make sure that I have a place to stay that's very, very nice. And all of these places that they put me in have hot showers. You think I'm not grateful for that? When I was living in Asia, it was a bucket of water and it was a splash bath. Now I get a whole shower. Wow. But being grateful, they're finding out right now that actually the more grateful you are for whatever in your life, your brain actually starts growing. And the frontal lobe starts to get a little bit bigger. And your mind tends to have more uplifting thoughts. So use gratitude and be grateful to yourself. Be kind to yourself. Don't be critical. Easier said than done. Takes practice. The next part, the next fold of the Eightfold Path is, they call it right action. I call it harmonious movement. Now, an interesting thing about the Eightfold Path, when the Buddha first taught the Eightfold Path to the five monks that he was teaching, he used a couple of phrases that the definitions that they're giving, even in some of the suttas, are not as accurate as it could be. The whole of the Eightfold Path that the Buddha taught has to do with mind and what you're doing with mind. So when I say harmonious movement, don't be jumping at things. Don't be trying to push things away. Don't be trying to stop things from happening. Because that's not harmonious movement. Harmonious movement is using the six R's in a relaxed, light way. Sometimes people want to use the six R's as a stick to beat away whatever is happening. It doesn't work. That's not harmonious movement, is it? It has to be light. Your mind needs to be light all the time. When you stop being critical to yourself or about yourself or critical of other things, your mind tends to be more light all the time. The next fold of the Eightfold Path is one that I've always really enjoyed because it didn't have anything to do with the first five monks. Right livelihood. Don't kill beings. Don't take slaves. Don't do anything with poisons. That's the definition that they give here. Well, the right livelihood, I call it harmonious lifestyle. Be careful of what you put in front of your mind. Now, this is with your daily activities. I had a lady that, she came to me, and she was from Malaysia. She came to me and she started complaining about having nightmares. I said, well, that's kind of strange. Why do you have nightmares? I don't know, but it seems like every time I go to the movies, that night I have nightmares. What kind of movies are you watching? Oh, I love horror movies. Well, okay, then don't do that anymore. Oh, but I love it. I said, fine, don't come complaining to me about your nightmares. Be careful of what you put in front of your mind. The next part of, or the next fold of the Eightfold Path, they call it right effort. I call it harmonious practice. And that is the six R's. Just plain and simple, that is the six R's. And then the next fold is called right mindfulness, and that word of mindfulness is really tricky. I call it harmonious observation. Now, sometimes when people start getting really deep in their practice, they start having these thoughts of, I wish I knew when this was going to, I want a attain nibbana. I'd really like to see it happen. I want it. And you have longing. That one little thought stops nibbana from occurring. So what do I tell people when they're starting to get close to this? Whenever you sit, you start by saying to yourself, I don't care what happens next. My job is just to observe whatever arises. I've had a lot of students that have come up to me and they've said that right after they had this attainment. They said, I didn't care. I don't care what happens next. This is interesting enough as it is. And the last fold of the Eightfold Path, they call it right concentration, which is very much misunderstood. I call it harmonious collectedness. And the definition of this is actually doing the TWIM and experiencing the TWIM jhanas, the jhanas that have the relaxed step in it. But it's all of the jhanas. That's what harmonious collectedness is about. Now, with straight vipassana, they've taken this to mean either access concentration or moment-to-moment concentration, and they're taking that from commentaries. The suttas don't have anything about access concentration in it, or moment-to-moment concentration. Doesn't have that. The suttas have the jhanas, the levels of understanding, the signposts that are actually more important for me to know than it is for you. Because that way I know how to talk with you, what you talk about. Every time you smile, you're practicing the entire Eightfold Path at that time. Every time you use the six R's, you're in practicing the entire Eightfold Path at that time. It's not a philosophy. This is real. You have a harmonious perspective when you six R, because you've let go of any attachments to a belief in a personal self. You have harmonious imaging, you have harmonious communication when you're smiling. You have harmonious movement when you're smiling. You have harmonious lifestyle. How are you affecting the world around you? You have harmonious practice. You have harmonious observation. you have harmonious collectedness. So every time you smile, you're practicing the entire Eightfold Path. And it improves your mindfulness. Your mind is light. Your mind is much more observant. And the speed that you notice things becomes much faster. So you start to see that a hindrance is starting to pull you down and you start noticing you. Oh, let's let that one go. Let's 6R, come back up. So the understanding of what the Eightfold Path is and how it's important to understand that this is part of dependent origination too. Your understanding starts to go much deeper. Now, you're sitting in meditation and eye consciousness arises or ear consciousness arises. And then there's that's contact. Then there is feeling. If it's a pleasant sound or sight, or if it's a painful sound or sight, then craving arises. When craving arises, clinging arises. When clinging arises, habitual tendency arises. When habitual tendency arises, the birth of action arises. When the birth of action arises, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise. And if your mindfulness is very sharp, you catch that right as it's happening and you relax, the feeling doesn't arise. If the feeling doesn't arise, the craving won't arise. If the craving won't arise, the clinging won't arise. If the clinging won't arise, the habitual tendency won't arise. If the habitual tendency won't arise, the birth of action won't arise. If the birth of action doesn't arise, there is no sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, or despair. That is called the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. And that's what I've been teaching you from day one. When I started talking about the five aggregates, when I gave you the definition of mindfulness, remembering to observe how mind's attention moves, when you start looking more closely at how it moves rather than why it moves, you start becoming familiar with it. The more familiar you are with it, the more you see right before that there was something else. And then when that comes up and you notice that little movement of mind's attention, then you relax again. You use the 6 hours again. And the rest of the links of dependent origination don't arise. That's how you're purifying your mind. Yeah.
I notice what you're saying. Is it possible to skip the first two and just go right to relax?
No. Yeah. Not right now. Later on, when you get into a deeper state, yes, then that's fine. But for right now, you need the 6 hours. Because you can still hold on to something. And you relax, but you're keeping your attention on something, and that doesn't work. Okay, you have to remember that this is a very important step. of wrecking or releasing, not keeping your attention on whatever it is that distracts you, and then relax, and then you have to go to your smile and back to your object of meditation. But I'm very confident that some of you are going to get into these deeper states of mind. I'm very confident. And as you do, you start noticing in different ways how this meditation really does work. Now, I say I teach loving kindness meditation. Well, I do. But that's only a small part of it. I'm teaching you the Brahma Viharas. And the Brahma Viharas will take you all the way to the realm of nothingness. Why doesn't it take you any deeper? Because mind gets too subtle. Neither perception nor non-perception. It's too subtle. You don't have you have to have a very, very quiet mind to be able to see this stuff. But it does happen naturally. You continue on and progress with your meditation. You follow the directions without changing them, without backing off from them. Just follow these directions. You will be successful. And a lot of people say, well, you focus too much on being successful. Well, I'm just talking about how much confidence I have in you. I know what you're going through. Yeah.
What do you mean by the realm of Bahama?
Neither perception nor non-perception?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Neither perception nor non-perception?
Brahma
Viharas is loving kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity. And this all happens by itself. You don't have to do it. All you have to do is stay on your object of meditation. It really does work. And as you start to go deeper into it, you're starting to see things that are quite remarkable. I mean, that was about 100,000 arising and passing away of ear consciousness. Happens fast. When you get to a certain place in this meditation, you'll be able to see individual ones arise and pass away. And then when you go deeper, of that one arising and passing away, you're going to see 12 parts of it. That's dependent origination. Your mind will settle down. You'll start to be able to sit for longer periods of time. Sitting for 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours is great. But I don't want you to sit with a lot of suffering. That's not good. It has to be natural. And that's when I'm going to tell you, you sat pretty long. Get up and get some exercise. Walk fast. Because you need that blood circulation. You really need to have that. There's some people that they'll sit for 3 or 4 hours and they'll get up for 5 minutes and then they'll come back because the sitting was good and they'll start sitting again. And they tend to have something that's like a blackout. It's not the cessation, it's a blackout. And that comes from not having good enough circulation. What your experience is sloth and torpor. So walking is a very necessary part of this practice. Get more oxygen in your system. Walk faster. And that helps your sitting immeasurably. At my center, I have some steps. I have a pretty big dining hall. And above that, we have a library. And there's outside steps. So I tell people to run up and down the stairs a few times. Get that blood circulating. It's really good. So tomorrow night you're going to hear a lot more about dependent origination. Okay? Any other questions? Loving kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity. Yeah.
I always look for shortcuts. And so, in the process of contact that begets a feeling, that begets perception about that feeling, that begets a craving, I'd like to go back and see if I understand that the feelings will come and go. They are just feelings. It's the arena of perceptions about the feelings that takes you down that terrible path?
No, it's the craving.
The craving. So yeah. The perception stage would be the...
Perception is the part of your mind that names the feeling. This is pleasant, this is painful. Okay, they always come together. If you use the 6 hours right then, at feeling, craving won't arise. And if craving doesn't arise, clinging doesn't arise. And then you go through that whole list of things that they won't arise anymore, so you're purifying your mind. But you will get to a time where you'll see the start of contact. You'll see it start to come up and you 6R then. And then feeling is not going to arise at all. And you'll get to a place where you'll see mentality and materiality, which is something I'll get into tomorrow. They call it nama rupa in Pali, but I really don't like the translation of mind and body, because that's not quite it. So I call it mentality and materiality. But when you get to really quiet places, you'll be able to see consciousness start to arise. When it does, you can 6R. But that's getting close to being able to experience Nibbana. Okay, let's share some merit then. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they alone protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.